The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Julie Wilson. Julie is the founder and executive director of the Institute for the Future of Learning, a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to transforming the factory model of education. From 2004 to 2014, Julie was a leadership and organization development consultant at Harvard University. During her tenure at Harvard, Julie received the Harvard Hero Award for outstanding performance and contributions to the university. Her writing has appeared on edweek.org, and she is an accomplished public speaker. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Kelly.
So I want to start today's conversation with an understanding of the central problem that you see in education. You said that, quote, the engagement for learning is being stripped out of our young people via the education system. So how so?
Well, this takes me back to some data. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Gallup organization and the great work they do on strengths and also employee engagement and student engagement. And they publish data year in, year out on student engagement. And it's pretty much a precipitous decline from kindergarten into high school with regards to student engagement. Students are highly engaged through kindergarten, and somewhere along the line, we lose them engagement-wise by the end of high school. And my belief is that's because the focus goes to subject and goes away from the learner.
So my kids go to Chicago Waldorf. They go to a Waldorf school. And so for people who don't know about that, the Waldorf education system was founded by a guy named Rudolf Steiner, who's got a very interesting and colorful background. But one of the things that I discovered as a parent at the Waldorf school was this is an institution that actually teaches the whole child. Some people are scared off because they delay, like, reading, but there's tons of music. They are the tons of art, theater. They are outside all the time. Like, one of the things you learn as a Waldorf parent is you better invest in, like, warm clothes and, you know, rain stuff. So
especially in Chicago.
Especially in Chicago, right? It's the worst. But you know, the and having grown up in a sort of a more traditional factory style educational system, I looked at this and I'm like, oh, I think this is the right way, and it really has served my children. And you've written a little bit about the Waldorf stuff, right?
Yes, I visited a number of Waldorf schools, and I love their approach, and it has stood the test of time over the past 100 years.
So I found this quote, I think it was in one of your articles by Eric Hoffer, and said, quote, in times of drastic change, it is the learners who inherit the future. The learned usually find themselves beautifully equipped to deal with a world that no longer exists. So I think this is what you're getting at, which is we're focusing on, you know, SAT scores as opposed to critical thinking.
Exactly. Yes, I'm going back to Steiner and Waldorf. I remember reading one of his lectures whenever he opened that first school in Stuttgart, Germany. And he talked about the power of thought, depth of feeling, and strength of will as being three core tenets. And it really struck me at the time. I sort of did a double take when I read the date. It was 1919, I think. And I just thought, well, that's the 1919 version of critical thinking, emotional intelligence, and resilience or grit, which is the terminology that we use today. So in many ways, I think it's kind of funny that I have this organization called the Institute for the Future of Learning, but so much of this work and my beliefs are grounded in work that was happening 100 years ago, and some might say many years before that with Socrates and really asking the learner to think for themselves from first principles.
So is this a cyclical problem, or is it something that was informed, you know, at a certain time in the United States for other reasons? I mean, how did we get where we are today?
Great question. My own sort of highly biased view here, the Prussian model that was taken and transplanted over here, the standardized testing subjects in silos, that is readily replicated. On the other hand, if you look to some of the more progressive models, those are organic in nature and not so readily replicated. So I think that's part of the challenge. It's also, I think, you know, I go back to natural law and the law of polarities, that, you know, maybe it's just the case that progressive education can't exist without a more standardized education system, and we will forever move between these polarities as a human race while we work out what the heck it is that we're doing and where we're going.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, it's true in many areas that you almost desire a tension between those two things. I was talking to a friend of mine who works for a non-for-profit, and I was suggesting that and Second City is a theater, but it's a for-profit theater. And I was suggesting that our tension between profit and purpose drives us in a really interesting, good way, in my experience.
Right.
So it is. I mean, it's perhaps you do need those that tension to drive against each other. I shouldn't have been surprised by this, I know, but you talk a lot about how if we're going to transform the educational experience for our children, we need to help adults unlearn a lot of their preconceived notions of what education should look like. And this doesn't get talked about. So what's the work we need to do on adults?
Great question. Yes, it's interesting because I come at this work in K-12 from the perspective of adult development. So I don't have a background as a classroom teacher. Hmm. My background is 20 years working in adult development and large-scale change. And after about 10 years of working with adults, particularly in leadership development, it became clear to me that this kind of theme emerging, that so much of what we were helping adults and leadership development programs was to unlearn what they learned through a standardized system of education. And I've been trying to think of another industry that we have in our modern day world where the vast majority of the Western world has gone through that system for between 10 and 12, maybe 16 years. And I can't think of any other than education. And our mental models are really strong with regards to what we think school is and should be. And, you know, if I'm a white 50-year-old guy making policy in education, I have a very particular idea of what education is. Right. And I may or may not have any real true understanding of an 8-year-old kid in the projects in Chicago and what that kid is facing on any given day and what he might need to thrive in what is essentially an unknowable future 10, 15, 20 years from now. So I think of it, I sort of have this mental image of the kids need to leapfrog the adults in many ways, which is why I lean heavily on, whenever I work with schools and districts, that we bring students into the conversation as early as possible. And ideally, we have a broad cross-section of the community in those initial design sessions. Everyone from the parents and the teachers, the administrators, of course, but also community members, city councillors, bring as many people into that conversation as possible. And I oftentimes run this activity, quick and dirty, grab some Post-its, think of the best learning experience you ever had and just capture a few notes on your post and get those up on the walls. And I've done this with thousands of people at this point, and I have yet to see a standardized test was a profound learning experience for me.
Of course you didn't. Who's going to put that down? No one is going to put that down. It's like saying, hey, you know what I really enjoy? Performance reviews. I think those are fantastic.
Or I have some feedback. Would you like to hear it? Oh, please, no. Keep that to yourself.
Thanks. Yeah. Or I love going to the dentist. It's the best trip. You know, the other thing that's interesting about your journey, which is you went from working in executive education to then go back to kids. And I don't know if you know the origin story of Second City, but a social worker at Jane Addams Hull House in the South Side developed these improv games for immigrant children to get them to better assimilate. And she was a teacher and she worked in the schools. And that became the formation of the pedagogy of improvisational learning. That was the formation of Second City in 1959, that we turned all those games into a way to create improv, to create comedy and sketches.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then now we're developing executive education programs at the University of Chicago. And because what we have, both of us have discovered is the stuff that is speaking to the kids is the stuff that's speaking to adults, because we're just human. And we need human practice in things like listening and cooperation and collaboration and empathy. And somehow in the past, someone decided that that was magic, or you either had it or you didn't, right? You're talented or you're not talented, which is bullshit. It's actually a thing that can be learned.
From a very early age, and in many ways, if it's done right, you build a very different set of skills as a young kid, young adult, and you don't have the same fear as an adult that we have, those of us who went through a more standardized system. I remember visiting Columbus Signature Academy. It's a new tech school in Columbus, Indiana, and the students took me on a tour of the school, and a group of them were working on a project, and they were talking about the coaching and feedback structure that they would use with each other for this particular project. And I was just struck by, these are 14-year-olds, and they have a facility and a language and a capability around this work that many 40- and 50-something-year-old executives still struggle with.
That's great. All right, and so, you know, a lot of people call this stuff soft skills, but you note that in the 2016 Future of Jobs report from the World Economic Forum, they cited the top three skills needed to thrive in 2020. And those three skills are complex problem solving, critical thinking, and creativity, which generally speaking, I think people think are soft skills, but they're the most important in a world of change, in a world of upheaval, in a moment of crisis. Those are the things that are needed, not, you know, necessarily remembering the date or some sort of rote thing. So what you're really talking about is embedding this learning as a frankly a survival technique.
Yes. Those skills, again, coming from executive ed background, have been coined for a few decades as the soft skills. But in my mind, they're the harder skills to learn. There is nothing quite like gathering a group of 20 adults and digging into, okay, let's talk about how to have difficult conversations.
Yeah.
To see perspiration just start to begin to form on everyone's foreheads. And creativity, you mentioned creativity. Creativity is interesting because we are born creative. And I'm sure you've seen Sir Ken Robinson's TED Talk where he breaks down beautifully how school kills creativity, that kindergartens score near genius levels for creativity. And again, that's another precipitous decline as we become adults, and as I would argue, we go through the standardized system. So in many ways, it's not so much filling this empty vessel. It's really trying to think, you know, carve the sculpture that's already there, and of course, build skills as you go. But what is the core of this person as a learner? What are their strengths? What innate talents and skills do they have? And how can I expose this learner to as many different opportunities as possible, where he or she can continue to build these skills? And ideally at the end of it, this is one of my big wishes, they have a sense of self-efficacy and self-direction.
Yeah. I want to jump into that too. So specifically, I found sort of like three core areas that you talk about that actually do relate a lot to our work. And one of them is this idea of sort of self-directed learning, because it involves the ideas of risk and failure. And a common theme through this podcast is that we are so risk-averse and failure-shy That we are missing out on the most essential ways that we actually learn. And frankly, because, you know, I always say this in a comedy context, like no one wants to hear a funny story about how you succeeded. You know, it like, right? Like that is never the funny story. Your fiasco is my, you know, funny story because you learn through the failed attempt. You talk about that as well, that we need to sort of create forums in which kids can try and fail because mm-hmm. that builds resilience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. The whole concept of setting safe goals, knowing that you will reach them, doesn't really prepare you for the real world. And you're reminding me of a great school in Atlanta called Mount Vernon, and one of their values is fail forward.
Mm.
That failure is not optional, and the only real failure is either not trying in the first place or not learning from the failed attempt.
That's interesting.
And it's just amazing to see those kids in action because the difference between a master and an amateur is the master has just failed way more times than the amateur has ever tried. And as I sit here, it's very easy to say it. It is really hard to do it as an adult.
Yeah. Well, we don't get practice in it, right? I mean, literally, what we have recognized at Second City is that, you know, it's like a workout. Like, you don't go to the mm-hmm. gym once and then you're good for the year. And so why would we think the same thing wouldn't apply to the sort of intrinsic qualities? So in improvisation, you fail all the time and you get back up. And then you find with improvisers, if, you know, they get rusty when they don't improvise. And part of that is that they haven't failed and they start to get in their fear and shame brain. And I've read some mm-hmm. research, you probably know about this, that a lot of learning takes place when you're just outside your comfort zone.
Yes, that whole that phrase, the zone of proximal development, mm-hmm. where if you're just outside of your comfort zone, you're so much more alert, you're taking in so much more information. But if you're way outside of your comfort zone, then your flight or fight responses start to kick into gear and learning is dramatically reduced. But there is this zone of proximal development where if we keep ourselves on the edge of that, then ongoing growth and development just occurs as a natural byproduct.
Yeah, so it's finding that balance and the toggle, right? Because, I mean, we can't control our environments. There's going to be times where we're way outside our comfort zone and times where we're way too comfortable. But you have to recognize that you also have agency inside of that. And this goes back mm-hmm. to we need the failure training not just for the kids. We need for the teachers because this does. It goes back and forth, and that's how we learn it.
Yes. So when I think about, you know, what's worth learning in schools, creativity, collaboration, critical thinking, and so forth, in many ways, the adults need to learn these skills alongside the kids mm-hmm. because we, the adults, don't have these skills either. And you could view that as, oh, we don't want to lose face in front of the kids or the parents. Or you could flip that and say, we're going to change our roles to be that of the lead learner. So we're going to make our own learning goals explicit to the kids. We're going to talk about our own professional development and what it is that we're working on, what it's like for me as a teacher to be outside of my comfort zone. And as a kid, if I'm seeing my teacher stretch him or herself in that way and they're engaging in this in a passionate way, that gives me permission to learn as opposed to feeling like I have to be right in this classroom.
I hadn't thought, and what you're talking about too is a bit of storytelling, right? So you're creating a narrative, your own narrative, for the kids to see and potentially model upon or reflect, even more importantly, but then giving them the opportunity to create their own narrative for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yes. And you know, a kid's narrative is everything to their learning. And if you can bring that narrative, yours in and the kids into the classroom, then you've got an incredible machine for learning right there. A machine is not even the right word. Just this incredible capacity for learning. I remember talking with a group of kids in a public school in Lynn here in Massachusetts, which can be a tough area. And I started to talk about neuroplasticity and how the brain can change. And you could see how the kids were just eating this up because the whole concept that you're either good at math or bad at math, or good at English or bad at English, those records, just to date myself back to the 1980s here, get laid down pretty quickly. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Carol Dweck's work out of Stanford, where she talks about fixed mindset and growth mindset. That applies to the adults as well. So I've worked with principals who've said that teachers can oftentimes do a great job of talking about their kids and the fixed mindset versus growth mindset and strategies to help turn things around. But then we get into the faculty meetings and so-and-so will never change. Well, that's just a fixed mindset about your colleague. So let's try and flip that and work with the growth mindset with our colleagues as much as we do with our kids as well.
That's great. Okay, I want to talk about another item you bring up, which is the idea of sort of teams. And at our philosophy in the improvisational world is we actually use the term ensembles because it sort of describes attributes and behaviors that live and grow forever and can, you know, survive people coming in and out. So at Second City, we've had these ensembles since 1959 there's rules about saying, you know, yes and rather than no, and about having your partner's back and making him look good and all these things. And you write in your upcoming book that you were so kind to send to me, quote, tolerance, empathy, and connection with others different than ourselves is not a nice to have. It's a non-negotiable that our young people don't repeat the same mistakes that we have made in the name of religion or perceived sovereignty. And what I love about this is essentially it's sort of a call for an ensemble of diversity and inclusion, that it requires people to sort of step outside their comfort zone, embrace the other, you know, it's in praise of introverts and extroverts, all that stuff. Talk a little bit about what it is sort of creating these teams.
Teams are integral to schools shifting away from the factory model. So the old model where I, a teacher, had anywhere between 20 and 30 kids in a classroom and shut my door. We're never going to get a truly interdisciplinary, project-based, real-world curriculum, one isolated teacher at a time. And what I find is a lot of teachers haven't had any learning and development around how to build and form teams. Mm-hmm. And people really need that experience of what it is. It's not just one and one equaling two. It's the exponential power of people coming together, where one and one can equal seven instead of minus three, which is the typical scenario. And all teams go through the forming, storming, norming, performing stages of team development. And there is always, and there will always be, this messy stage where we're trying to work out how we're going to work together. And people need tools for that and structure for that. And in the same way that improv has its tools and its structure, in order for that freedom and that creativity to bubble up, you need the boundaries along with the flexibility as well. And those schools that are doing phenomenal work, they are invariably team-based. And also, and this is really important, those teachers have time to collaborate. Right. There is time carved out in the school schedule to do that on a regular basis, not just once or twice a year.
And are you also talking about the idea of that there are many teams, right? So you have the team of teachers their supervisors. You have the team that exists in the classroom. You have teams with the parents that if we start to think about, and again, we use the term ensemble, but that these are all ensembles who are working together when we can at different points. Mm-hmm. That's a different orientation that, you know, most all of us never had any practice or experience or learning in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so. So a school I was working with in California a few months ago, they brought their whole community in to rethink the curriculum in the school. And they purposefully have both board members and students on their teams. Hmm. So it's not just teachers, it's not just administrators, but we're really bringing diversity of perspective into this conversation. And I'll never forget that a school I was at where we were talking about rethinking assessment and how you might begin to assess these skills like creativity and collaboration. And one of the teachers mentioned in a team setting that we already assess character. It's already on the report cards of how this is different. And a student raised his hand and said, yes, but that's not important. And she said, what do you mean it's not important? She said, well, the first page of the report has the subject, and that's in what I think is a size 14 font. The character piece is on the second page, and I think it's in like a size 8 or 9 font. So that leads me to believe that it's not important.
Wow.
And it was amazing getting that perspective in the room, which cut through maybe 6 or 7, you know, walking around the bushes kind of, kind of meeting and really getting to the core of this. And then the student, you know, just kept pushing, okay, so is this more important than the grades for the subject? What's really important? And the students' questions were really driving the conversation forward. And we wouldn't have had that level of clarity were he not in the room.
Well, you got, yeah, and this is another thing that pops up, which is, you know, you got to put people in the room together. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you're getting to groupthink. It doesn't mean that you have to have consensus. In fact, but you need input and you need to have people speak truth to power. And so there are guardrails for that. We've talked a lot about this recently, that for creative environments, and I work in a tremendously creative environment, we have so many constraints that are built around that because we know we're just moments away from slipping off into chaos. So yeah, as you can well imagine, right? Working with a bunch of comedians. This is true of all these creative endeavors. So, you know, there are constraints so that we can get back on track and so we can make decisions and we can pare down and do all that hard work. But within that, there is room for that massive self-expression and that speaking truth to power. And a lot of that means that you just get people in a room to contribute and be heard. And it's amazing what happens when you let someone be heard with regard to then their feeling of investment and you know, the big word, which is engagement.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. And when you mentioned guardrails, it's helpful to give people tools. Because so often, particularly in a team environment, somebody throws out a question and then the person who often speaks first. And then sometimes the group think can just follow that one sort of louder voice at the table. But something as simple as, okay, I'm going to throw out a question. Everybody write down your thoughts on some post-its on a clip chart and let's get them up here. All of a sudden, if you've got 12 people in the room, you've got 12 opinions in less than 2 minutes on the table. And it can really help shift the conversation.
I want to touch on this idea of change management. So you dealt with this at Harvard, right? As an executive, this is something that constantly comes up. This is the call we get in our corporate services department every single day, which is my people people won't change. They're change adverse. They are, you know, they're stuck in their ways, all this stuff. And in your book, you write, quote, being adaptable is a key part of leading any successful change effort. You are almost 100% guaranteed that your plan will not work out as planned, but you do need a plan. Hold it lightly and stay on course. Before I let you respond, I want to tell you an improv adage that's in the Second City Almanac of Improvisation. And it's, quote, when you're improvising, you need to wear your character as lightly as you would a hat.
Nice.
And I found a connection to that, which is like, yeah, you walk in with your character, but you have to be able to shift in a moment when something unexpected or different comes your way.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about your ideas in terms of change and the skill you're imbuing the kids with.
Mm-hmm. So the majority of my work is with the adults and helping them change. I think in many ways it's easier for the students to change. They haven't learned the bad habits that we do.
Good point.
It's easy to see it just, you know, get a little bit worse as kids go through high school and you start to feel the pressure of college admissions, where they're encouraged not to change course at that point and to really, you know, focus on something and, you know, drive towards it, which in my mind is premature. But when it comes to the adults, I'm a great believer in establish your North Star. So this is the direction in which you're headed. And ideally, that's a compelling North Star, and you've really tapped into your why and why this is important. And then be entirely flexible as to how you get there. There could be any one of 10 million paths or roads that will get you there. But if you get too locked in on one way, then you can miss a fantastic opportunity because you were so focused on, quotes, following the plan. And the reality is that when you're transforming from a school model that is grounded in control, consumption, and compliance, the one that's inviting people to be more creative and to solve problems and to think critically and to embrace risk, that is a 5 to 7 year process. And it is a process of trial and error. We're back to failure again. We're back to giving people permission to try something, to pivot and then to try something else. And any good change management strategy provides that breadth. And I've started to change the language that I use around change management and not thinking of it so much as change management as how can we mobilize people to change. It's more of a mobilization, top-supported, bottom-up, inside-out, how do we mobilize this community towards this North Star and getting as many ideas into that conversation as we can and getting the people who will move forward and implement.
You had a great phrase that I wrote down, which was applying knowledge with a bias for action.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me like that's sort of what you're talking about, is instilling this bias to act, or a bias to be, you know, change ready or agile, which I think is a really interesting, you know, sort of shift in an approach. Because maybe when you hear the word change management, it's like hearing the word performance review.
Yes. And all appetite for failure goes out the window at that point.
Yeah.
It also, I think, gives a false impression that the leaders know exactly what they're doing.
Right. Right.
More often than not, yes, the leaders know the direction we're going, but as far as some magical spreadsheet sitting on a Google Drive or Dropbox somewhere with how we're going to get there, it doesn't exist.
Nope.
And nor should it.
Yeah, I remember my very first job at the Jewel food store at Plaza del Lago in Wilmette, Illinois, and it took me like a week of working there to realize, like, this is like sustained chaos. No one really knows what's going on, but somehow it's working. And that has been my experience in every place I've worked, which is like, there's no magic plan anywhere. It's like we should be happy that we're all here. Before I ask you for your yes and story, because we're butting up against time, and these conversations are so awesome, and I wish we could talk forever. I'm curious. So you have a mountain in front of you, right, in terms of what you're trying to accomplish. So where do you center yourself when you look at, like, the task ahead, how hard it potentially is to you know, try to change something that's so seemingly rooted in unchange? You know, how do you psych yourself up in the morning? How do you get yourself to not feel like this is too daunting a task?
Well, I do have my days where I think this is just crazy. This can't be done. But then I have days where I walk through a school like that school in Columbus, Indiana, where I see kids doing phenomenal work and realize that other folks have walked this path before. And I sort of shifted away from, I started this work 10 years ago wanting to find the silver bullet. Okay, what is the silver bullet? And let me look into all of the change management literature, see what I can find here. There is some wonderful flowchart or formula or model or framework that will help unpack all of this and provide the answers. But what I realized my role is to help the change agents. There are a bunch of stories in that book. There are some models and frameworks. And given all of those frameworks, I go back time and time again to the eternal truth of the hero's journey and Joseph Campbell's work. And at its heart, this work is a voyage and a quest from the known world to the unknown world. And the more people that we have doing this work, the more we're going to see the change that we want to see. And in those times when I feel dispirited, I think back to William Wallace and Braveheart. And what will happen if you do nothing?
Yeah.
Nothing will happen. And, you know, we're on this planet for a pretty short period of time. And if I can help put just the tiniest of a dent into it and maybe help some other people do that as well, I think there will be a point to me being here.
I'm going to take the leap that this is going to be the awesome transition to your yes and story. I just know it is. So we ask every guest what their yes and story is, this idea in improv, which is you get nowhere if you say no when you're creating something out of nothing. And you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. What's mm-hmm. your story for us?
My story is the book.
Yeah.
2 years ago, I approached a number of publishers with what I thought was a beautiful proposal. And of course, I would say yes to my thinking around education and how it needed to change. And I kept getting no after no after no. And another version of me would just have said, okay, obviously this is not the right time. I'll just stop this. But there was another yes and voice that I heard, which was, yes, you've got a whole bunch of no's here, and you need to write this book. So I told myself I would just start to write. And if a publisher picked it up, that would be great. If not, I would self-publish. And I would have faith that there was something here. And there were so many yes ands over that 1.5 year period, because I would wake up in the morning with, quote, no time to write. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I'm going to write for 20 minutes.
Right.
Then wake up another morning. Okay, I the last thing I want to do is to sit down and write. It's like everything in me is pushing against this. Yes, and put your behind in the chair and start writing. You have permission to get up after 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And at times it felt like an exercise in self-torture. And then I would read the War of Art and Cheryl Strayed and her book and a whole bunch of others who have walked this path before, and just tell myself to get over myself and just write the book. And it may indeed be awful, and that first draft was awful. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, sort of smiling whenever I read about Anna Mott, and she would talk about the shitty first draft.
Yep.
And I didn't realize, oh, it is actually awful. I wouldn't actually show it to anybody. Yep. Somewhere in my head I thought, oh, you know, it won't be wonderful, but it'll just need a few tweaks and, of course, some editing, but, you know, there'll be some good stuff there. No, it was truly awful.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and sit back down and do version two. And it was, I think, version four where it started to come together for me. And I was struck by the irony of it when I was pulling things together, and I did find a publisher who did say yes, and Portland's going to publish, and they're a wonderful organization. I was struck that something I talk about in the book is how the industrial model of education perpetuates this sense of learned helplessness and waiting for permission. So whenever I get these grades, then I have permission to go forth and do this. When I go to college, then I'll have permission to go and do this. And I realized that I've been waiting for permission for the book, for somebody to tell me that I could write the book. And I think the universe just put me on a path where I had to own that, to say yes and start writing, and then just have faith to see where it would take me.
It's brilliant. Julie Wilson, she is the founder and executive director of the Institute for the Future of Learning. You can find them online. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Kelly.
Well, I've been working in a